Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is the moral basis of capitalism with Dr. Paul Prentice. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Well, very happy to have you with us. So, folks, Dr. Paul Prentice is a founding faculty and professor of economics at Yorktown University. He's an adjunct fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute and a founder and president of the Pikes Peak Economic Club in Colorado. I also want to welcome our special commentator today, Mr. Christopher Opperman. Welcome, Christopher.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, glad to have you as well. So Chris is currently an undergraduate at Harvard, and I met Chris while he and I were attending Mises University in 2009. Chris has the distinction of being one of the award-winning young scholars at the 2009 Mises University. So let's get started with this right away. Paul, you've written and spoken a lot about the moral basis for capitalism. Why do you think it's important to defend capitalism on moral grounds?
Well, it's actually critical, in my opinion, because what we have is a lot of the argument going on today is based on utilitarian grounds. In other words, is socialism better for us in producing goods and services and distributing the fruits of that production, or is capitalism better? That's a very utilitarian argument about which simply creates greater levels of income and wealth, and people argue and argue and argue about that. But what to me is not arguable is the moral basis of these two systems, and particularly the moral basis of capitalism, based on fundamentally free people engaging in voluntary exchange, and that is just so morally superior to any other system.
So if I can interrupt you, so when you're saying utilitarian grounds, is that the same thing as saying that morals don't matter?
Yes, in a sense that Stalin is famous. I think it was Stalin. It might have been Lenin, though. I get them mixed up. For saying that when he was accused of killing too many people, that he just said, well, you know, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. That's a very utilitarian approach. You know, you get greater, you're looking at the quantity of output compared to the quantity of input. You're looking at quantities of things. You're not looking at people.
Okay. So, Chris, you wanted to talk about something that the Greek philosophers brought out. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, Socrates had a famous saying that all knowledge begins with the definition of terms. So I wanted to ask Dr. Prentice, I guess in your experience, what do people usually think about when they hear the word capitalism? I mean, how correct is the portrayal we get from Hollywood and the press about what capitalism is?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you, I've got a great story on that. I have a former MBA student whom, when I asked the class, just in general, what did you think of the word capitalism to start, because we have to define terms so we can communicate. And she was from Oregon, from Corvallis, I believe. And she said, well, capitalism, that's a system whereby the rich and the strong exploit the poor and the weak. So that was her definition of capitalism. So we had quite a long ways to go to define and properly define the system. And I believe in many people's minds, because of the perversions that come out of Hollywood themselves and the perversions in the modern academy, and by that I simply mean higher education, a lot of people have that view, and it's simply incorrect.
Sure. So I guess if you had to correct her in a nutshell, what would you say is authentic capitalism?
And you have 10 seconds to answer that question.
Yeah.
Authentic capitalism is simply people engaging in voluntary production and exchange. It's that simple. It's
beautiful.
Voluntary.
Well, we're going to come back after a break. And actually, I wanted to mention that my daughter said we should rename the show How We Can Do the Right Thing and Still Make Money. And that was her translation for this. So, folks, stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Dr. Paul Prentice. and we're talking about the moral basis of capitalism. And we have with us our special commentator today, Mr. Christopher Opperman. So, Chris, you had just asked Paul before the break, what is authentic capitalism? And, Paul, you gave a brief answer. Go ahead. I know that you had more to ask Dr. Prentice on that.
Sure. Well, Dr. Prentice, I think very much along the lines of what you said. I mean, we were getting to the idea that the essence of capitalism isn't exploitation or greed, but it's simply freedom and peaceful cooperation. It's voluntary exchange. I think along those lines, there's a helpful quote from Adam Smith from The Wealth of Nations, and he says that little else is requisite to carry a state to the highest degrees of opulence, but peace, easy taxes, and the tolerable administration of justice. What do you think of that quote by Smith?
Well, it's a powerful quote. Actually, I have it on the wall of one of my classrooms. It really is striking when you think about it. What it says is that if we have peace, easy taxes, and tolerable administration of justice, he's really talking about a system of limited government and protection of private property rights, of protection of rights, and having the rule of law behind all of that. It's not so much that you would have no law, but you'd have a justice-type-based law, really in the way that Justinian himself was talking about law. Law must be just, it must be fair, and it must protect people equally. And when you have that, and the quote goes on to say that something about people's natural inclination to better themselves, subject to the moral code of not hurting other people, is sufficient to carry them on. So just people left alone. In other words, I get all the time, it's shocking how many policy advisors I run into who ask me opinions, you know, and politicians who ask me about this or that. And my response in each and every case is simply, take your hand out of my pocket and leave me alone. You know, it's so simple, isn't it?
Right.
But that's because human beings are hardwired. We are by nature wealth producers and wealth creators, and it's not that you make people into that. You simply get out of our way. You get out.
No,
of
I
our
want
way.
To jump in here. I had the pleasure of listening to another one of your interviews, and. You tell a wonderful story about Cicero and the story of natural law and natural rights. Would you go into that a little bit, Paul?
Well, sure. There's a long and glorious history, of course, of this. Western tradition doesn't just come out of the blue. Jefferson didn't wake up one day and say, Shazam, I've got it, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and nor did John Locke just wake up and say, I've got it, life, liberty, and property. But going way back to Cicero in as early as maybe 50 B.C. or so, he was a Roman statesman, and he traveled around his known world of the time, which was fairly extensive. As you know, the Roman Empire was, in fact, an extensive empire. And he traveled to all the various cultures and lands, and they were extremely diverse, all the way from what we would call now the barbarian tribes of Europe to the more civilized countries in the Middle East and even off into the Far East and down into northern Africa. And he observed that every society was based on some type of law of some kind. And he saw that he could categorize the idea of law into two basic categories in the following manner. Every society had some kind of set of rules, for example, about what side of the street you could park your horse on, if you will. You know, what he called administrative law. How do you administer, from a legal perspective, the social institutions? And he called that administrative law. But on the other hand, he saw that every society had rules that prescribed against the wanton taking of life and property. There were certain regulations under which you could do these things, but you couldn't just do them whenever you felt like it. And even in Europe and some of the other places, the Druid places they found, you couldn't just go ahead and take somebody's life. You had to have a full moon and an altar, for example. And, you know, there's some restriction upon that action. And it was so endemic to humanity, he thought it was like a natural law, sort of like a law of mathematics. He was thinking, as the Greeks and maybe the Romans of the day did, that life consisted of scientific type of laws. And he was thinking, well, gosh, this is a law of human nature, isn't it? Because he saw this everywhere, that there's some sort of natural law. And from this, eventually America gets the idea of natural rights and our creator endowed natural rights coming out of Jefferson. Go back to Cicero, in fact.
You know, Chris, you know, I took you off your track, Chris, because I know you had some other questions you wanted to insert at this particular point. Please go ahead.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I think that I guess going back to the thread we've had going about, you know, what true capitalism is. I mean, I think we see a lot of this misunderstanding all over the place, generally speaking, especially with the financial crisis and markets and greed and all of this, you know, unregulation are being blamed for the crisis. But I had a question for Dr. Prentice. I mean, in your experience, how does the debate change when people realize that they're not actually criticizing capitalism, but that they're criticizing a kind of crony capitalism, a false capitalism that really isn't a real free market?
Well, you have the crux of the real debate, and you ask me how does the debate change. It's very hard to get people to see that, and frequently when I face them with the facts, when they come at me and saying, well, capitalism just failed, obviously, because the markets crashed, and I say, well, there was not much capitalism in there. Most of those bad loans were directed by and commanded by government policy and government regulators. It was not deregulation that caused that. It was regulation. No capitalist in their right mind would go ahead making loans that they knew they couldn't get paid back. It's just preposterous, right? So one thing I do, and I'll say to them, well, here's an idea I have for you. I'm going to start a company. The company is going to give out loans to people who can't pay them back. Do you want to invest in me? You know, and it kind of shuts them up. They have to think it through. But yes, much of what, actually I would say almost all of what failures are government failures, but they're blamed on the markets. And Ayn Rand mentioned this in some of her writings, particularly in a great little book called Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. She's got some essays in there about how it's almost deliberate in the fact that these command and control people, they control an economy, therefore they wreck it, and then they blame the wrecked economy on the market and call for more command and control. And isn't that 50 years ago, wasn't she writing about today's headlines?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, almost
you know, I want to insert here that one of the things that kind of gets me going is when people get on their high horse against corporations as if the corporations themselves are the real problem, where I see two problems with that approach. One is that it ignores that the fundamental problem is related to what we could call interventionism, which I think is a much better term than corporatism or even crony capitalism, because it really discusses or presents the idea that it is the intervening, if you will, by government that actually is the real problem. But this bridges to the next point that I wanted to bring out, which is about moral hazard. And, you know, the problem is that the focus is on those who took the bait, you know, the bad corporations and so on and so forth. But the better focus is on the bait itself and who set the bait. And that isn't really what is commonly discussed. So, Paul, I'd like to throw that at you in kind of a open kind of way to let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's amazing. You actually saw into the second part of my discussion of when somebody asks me about this, and I say, do you want to buy in to that business model I just told them? And of course, they say no. And I say, well, how about this? I'm going to make loans to people that can't pay them back. We'll make a lot of money until they can't pay them back. And when they can't pay them back, I'll have someone else pay us for that. We should buy in then. And they'll go, yeah, we'll buy in. So that's
sure.
Exactly what you're getting at. The whole idea of moral hazard, where the incentives are skewed because the businessman, would be able to get the profits, the private profits from that activity, but I'd be able to socialize the losses, i.e. I'd be able to put the losses off onto the government or onto the taxpayer to make up the difference when they go bad. And that's exactly, once again, what happened in this financial crisis.
Yeah, this is the essential problem with moral hazard, is that it passes the risk to someone else.
Yes. And yes, the person that gets the benefit is not the same person that pays the cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Michael, I think this actually was an issue that was raised a lot during the debate over the latest regulation bill that was passed. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, you know, one of the criticisms that one of my economics professors actually raised when he went down to Congress to testify was that the regulations did nothing to change the underlying incentive structure. And so even now, financial institutions, if they're in trouble, the regulations actually encourage them to, you know, get run into the ground faster, because everyone else will get hit with the risk and with the financial damage. So I think that's a great example of how the incentives are just totally skewed in this case.
Exactly. So, Chris, I'm going to let you set up the next question. We're not going to have time to even let Paul even start to answer it, but please go ahead.
Okay. Well, I guess at the end of the day, I think Dr. Prentice was getting at the point that a lot of the ethical criticisms of capitalism don't always have to do so much with ethics as with the economic consequences that people think come from capitalism, like the exploitation of workers or greed or how people put profits over people. And so I guess we should talk about that a little bit and see what are the real economic consequences of capitalism.
Right. Well, Paul, again, we come into the end of our segment, and I unfortunately I don't want to cut you off, so I'm not even going to let you get started.
Okay.
And we will come back to this particular point when we get back. So everyone, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Dr. Paul Prentice and Mr. Christopher Opperman on the moral basis of capitalism. And we'll be back in just a second. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. And before the break, Chris, you started a question to Dr. Prentice. Please go ahead.
All right. Well, Dr. Prentice, I guess in a nutshell, what do you say to people that say that capitalism is evil because it promotes things like greed and profits over people?
Well, the first thing I say is if you don't like human greed, you have to take it up with the manufacturer. The fact is, we are hardwired for what we would call self-interest, a better way of saying that word. And Adam Smith's entire idea here was that we needed the enlightened self-interest. It really comes from the Scottish Enlightenment and several philosophers before and concurrent with Adam Smith. But enlightened self-interest means that we pursue our self-interest as long as we don't get in the way of other people expressing their self-interest, and hence we get this voluntary system. So it's very important that we understand it's not greed. Greed, coveting, or taking what doesn't belong to you, what is not rightfully yours. Well, it's not greedy to try to make money, especially if the money is made by voluntary exchange. So it's a completely different way of looking at that word. And as you mentioned with Socrates, our definitions are sort of backwards or upside down or perhaps on purposefully skewed to make nonsense out of what is really very sensible. It's greed. It's the left that's greedy. They covet our money and our income. They want to take it from us by force and violence. Is that not greed? How are they less greedy than I, who has made my money by voluntary trade and exchange with my fellow man?
Yeah, so, I think to that effect,
I'm insulted when they call me greedy.
Right. Well, exactly, because I think to that effect, Thomas Sowell has a very nice saying that he's always mystified why it's never greedy to want to spend someone else's money, but the moment you want to spend your own, then you're hounded down as being greedy.
Tom Sowell, he's brilliant, isn't he?
Absolutely.
That's great. Well, you know, Paul, the question of exploiting workers and consumers is one of the most widespread arguments used against capitalism. How do you counter this argument?
Well, again, it's a matter of definition of terms, isn't it? Well, I would ask somebody to say, define to me what you mean by exploit. You know, define that term. Is it exploiting somebody? If they're willing to work for me for $10 an hour and I'm willing to pay them $10 an hour, is exploiting them if they're willing to work for me for $8 an hour and I'm willing to pay them $8 an hour? How is that exploiting them? So the term itself, the exploitation, you find that it's a vacuous term. There's nothing behind it. It's a very emotional term. It pulls at the heartstrings, but it has no real meaning. There's no meaning in the world that I live in where people engage in voluntary trade. The only exploitation occurs when somebody puts a gun to my head and tries to take my money.
Do you run into that particular concept with the students that you are with in college, Chris?
A fair bit. I mean, and I really do think that the problem simply is that they don't really understand exactly what it is that we're talking about. There really isn't an agreement on pinning down what the precise definition is. Because once you think about it and you really, you know, explain to them, like Dr. Prentice has been saying, I mean, at that point they begin to realize that, well, my position really doesn't make as much sense anymore. So it's definitely a widespread sentiment in colleges.
So please go ahead, Chris.
So I guess we've kind of discussed some of the beneficial consequences of capitalism and free markets. I know Adam Smith has his, you know, famous concept of the invisible hand. Another related insight is Frederick Hayek's perspective about dispersed knowledge. And his idea was that only markets could coordinate all of the information needed to run something as complex as an economy. And I think that's something that's overlooked a lot, and especially when we're talking about things like exploitation of workers and things like that. Because if workers are being exploited, then the question is, well, how much should they be paid instead? And I guess, Dr. Prentice, I should ask you, can governments actually know what the just price or the just wage is for a worker?
That's ultimately what Hayek himself called the fatal conceit, the idea that government could know any such set of information. Consider this, not only how complex the economy is, let's take a simple thing out of that economy, and you're familiar with the SAI pencil. A pencil is so common and so cheap that you walk past one discarded on the street, you don't even bother to pick it up. But yet it's a modern marvel of metallurgy, of engineering, of manufacture, of agronomy, of shipping, of mining. Think of all the things that go into it. And there's not one human being on the earth, not one, that knows the entire process, start to finish, of making a pencil. Yet it happens without any government control. It happens by thousands of people pursuing their enlightened self-interest, given their resource base, their understanding of their opportunity costs, their own values and their trade-offs. And the next thing you know, there's pencils all around us. It's just phenomenal. And that's just a pencil. And if the government couldn't plan a pencil, how could it plan an economy?
Right, exactly. You know, this essay you mentioned, I'd like to emphasize to all the listeners that they should, if they can, look this particular essay up, I, Pencil. It was written, it's available online in a free PDF from multiple different sites, and it's one of the most wonderful lessons about cooperation and prosperity and how we don't need to know anyone else. In fact, we're never going to know all the different people that help us become prosperous. It's a spontaneous ordering of society. And again, folks, we are coming into another segment, the end of a segment here, and so please stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. And so this is Radio Free Market. And I'm your host, Michael McKay. I'll talk to you in just a minute. Thank you. And welcome back, everyone. And so, Paul, before the break, we just were talking about Hayek's perspective about dispersed knowledge, and you brought up this excellent essay as a reference point. I want to emphasize again that all our listeners should look up iPencil and read that. It's a short essay, and they can pick it up on a PDF if they just Google that, iPencil. And I want to go to another topic here. This is a good way for us to get into the discussion of real capitalism and real capitalism's worldview and a socialist's point of view or worldview. Does the socialist assume too much when he thinks that public officials have the knowledge and skill to run an economy?
Well, it's much more than that. Not only do they assume and presume too much about the technical knowledge, but think about what they're assuming about the moral character. They're assuming that these people that would presume to control us would do so for our best interests, that they not only know better than us than we do ourselves about what's good for us, but their only interest is in our well-being. And You know, you look through human history, you don't see too many rulers like that. You see, you know, that for every Solomon, there's a thousand Hitlers, aren't there? It's just not human nature. The human nature, the power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So Lord Acton had it right. And people that want to control shouldn't.
I think Ludwig von Mises actually makes this point very forcefully in his book called Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. And I guess he doesn't hammer down the aspect about them being more moral necessarily, but he does say that the socialist worldview kind of operates under this delusion that there is such a thing as central planning and that people really can coordinate these kinds of things.
Yes, it's the idea that this price mechanism can be controlled. When price is a discovery process based on producers' costs and really their sense of their opportunity cost and consumers' values, which are very fickle, as we know, because we're human beings and they change all the time. And how could somebody then say at what price does consumer value equal producer cost and therefore giving us the correct allocation of scarce resources? What authority could possibly come up with that price? But yet it happens in the marketplace spontaneously all the time. It's simply phenomenal. It's phenomenal how impossible it is to functionally control this and make it work in any kind of meaningful way. As Mises said, you can't calculate it. How do you know that a gallon of milk ought to be priced at approximately a gallon of gasoline? Well, it just so happens that that's the current trade-off ratio between them, but how do you know that that's the right one? What is the right one? Well, there is no right price. The right price is the market price. These are relative prices of this compared to that. And there's no way for anybody to control that properly.
Now, you know, you mentioned Hayek's fatal conceit. Chris, you dug up a quote from that. Do you want to give that quote?
I did. In the fatal conceit, Hayek writes, "The curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design."
I think that's a great
phrase. Imagine they can design. Isn't that a great phrase? What a great turn of phrase. Because it's nothing but pure imagination. It is fantasy that these people think that they can design this thing. It's quite amazing.
Well, you know, I think this point really reiterates the importance of being grounded in reality economics, which is what we here at Radio Free Market like to refer to as Austrian economics. We like to refer to it as reality economics because reality is not optional, and what we're really talking about is how the world really works. And speaking as an economist, in what ways does the economic reality, the economic way of thinking, impact your view of the world? How does the reality-grounded economists like yourself, Paul, see things differently than, say, his socialist or interventionist colleagues?
Gosh, there's actually two ways, and I don't know if I have time for both, but the quick answer to that is we understand the reality of scarce resources versus virtually unlimited human wants and needs. That is the fundamental economic problem, is it not? If resources were not scarce, we could have everything we wanted, as much of it, whenever we wanted it. But we can't. We have to face trade-offs. We have to look at the opportunity cost. If we're going to choose A, we have to give up B. And that's the fundamental economic way of thinking, is involved in opportunity costs and trade-offs based on the notion of scarcity. Therefore, we have to optimize. We have to economize on our resource base and get the most out of it that we can. So we think about how we can do that. And most of us that have studied that problem, the problem that's vexed mankind ever since we've been around, the solution to that has been shown time and time and time again to simply allow people, set them at liberty to pursue their enlightened self-interest, not their selfish self-interest, but their enlightened self-interest. And there has to be a moral code under which this occurs. Without the moral code, you see what happens with our highest levels of our businesses and highest levels of our other institutions as well. The moral code is very important that people understand that basic idea that we're at liberty when we set other people at liberty. It really is fundamentally a Judeo-Christian moral code, although it's found in other cultures as well.
Go ahead, Chris.
So I think that with at least some people, we can see that most of these quibbles with capitalism, especially the ones coming from the interventionist worldview, really just stem from not understanding what it actually is.
I think that's right. I think that all of us could do the world a great service simply by defining our terms more clearly and more precisely and refusing to accept their definitions. So frequently I see and watch and observe arguments between people who think of capitalism, capitalists, and socialists, and mostly on our side we tend to accept the ground rules that the left sets for us and the definitions they throw at us. And so we have a very hard time articulating back against it. We have to say, no, that's an incorrect definition. Here's the correct definition. Let's discuss it now that we understand what we mean by that word greed. Let's discuss it now that we understand what we mean by that word scarcity. Those kind of things. When you get to that level, then you can finally have a civilized debate about this.
So, you know, Chris, you did some work on this, and you wanted to break this down into finer detail. So let's take this another step. Let's go to the next level on this. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think we've talked extensively, I think, about the economic differences, but Dr. Prentice, in your speeches and your writing, you've also argued that capitalism and socialism are not different just when it comes to economics. There's a world of difference when it comes to the respective views on other things in the world. What beside economics comes to mind when you're speaking about the respective capitalist and socialist worldviews?
You know, there's a lot of those things, so I'm going to just give you a softball here, Paul, and let's just kind of tick off some of them. Let's start with ethics.
Well, certainly it's the ethics. The ethics is in the world of philosophy, it's simply called the ethics of reciprocity. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's known as the golden rule. Thou shalt do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Or the ethics of reciprocity is to, I'm at liberty if I set you at liberty, so I pursue my self-interest and I don't do anything to prevent you from pursuing your self-interest. I don't use force or coercion to prevent you from pursuing yours. That's an ethics. That's the moral code. But yet to a socialist, to a leftist, that's not their sense of ethics at all. Their sense of ethics is, as Marx said, from each according to their means, from each according to his ability, to each according to their needs.
Right.
So in my world, the capitalist world, it's immoral to steal from somebody. But in the socialist world, you have to understand, your reader, your listeners need to understand, in the socialist world, it is perfectly moral to steal from somebody. If I need something and you've got it, it's a moral act for me to take that from you or to use the government to take it from you. So it's very difficult to communicate sometimes with these people because of the very structural understanding of the nature of what is right and what is wrong. The ethics.
Well, I'll tell you, this is so perfect that you're saying these things. I'm just so excited about this. I want to have you back up for just a second and reiterate this phrase that you used that I first heard when I listened to one of your other interviews, where you say this code of reciprocity. You know, I've heard the golden rule referred to as a lot of things, the first law, et cetera, and I know that the majority of religions in the world have a version of it that they work with. And we've talked about that in other shows here on Radio Free Market. But this, I've never heard this term before, this code of reciprocity. Boy, that sure sums it up beautifully.
Yeah, it's found in, I think it's 21 out of 23 of the world's major belief systems, religions, philosophies, all of them, the two that I can find where it's not is Marxism and Satanism, but then I tell my audience that that's redundant.
Well, geez, what a surprise.
Cicero might have called that a natural law, wouldn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, because, I mean, it really is, it sums it up basically beautifully, you know. Are you going to respect people and their property or not? And if you're going to try to make it moral to steal from one another, and you're going to somehow declare that to be correct or right, then of course, there's a gulf that separates that and the golden rule. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Chris, I interrupted you. You were going to take Paul through the next layer, because I know that you've been doing some really fine work on this. in preparation for this.
Sure. Well, I guess really quickly, just to follow up to what you've been exploring, Michael, as well, is that I think it's interesting to see, as Dr. Prentice mentioned, that it is a very biblical principle. I think you can find examples like that in the Bible. You know, in places like the Sermon on the Mount, and you know that's where we often find the golden rule phrased. But Dr. Prentice, I think that there's another difference here between the different worldviews. I think that we've touched on this already a little bit, but there is this difference about the broader view of reality and what how reality can be molded, whether reality is objective or subjective, I guess we could say. Can you comment on that? You know, what is the socialist idea of reality?
Sure. If you don't mind, let me first just finish up with the idea of the code of reciprocity. There's one more thought that comes to mind, which is in the book of James, the golden rule, as it stated, as to love your neighbor as yourself, that's known as the law of liberty. It's actually called that, and he uses that word, the law of liberty. So anyway, so I'll go on.
That's beautiful. That's in the book of James, huh?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's referred to that way. Now that I went off on a tangent, you have to restate your question, I apologize.
Yeah, it's okay.
That's okay. So I think that there is a kind of difference here in that the capitalist worldview seems the capitalist basic philosophy, let's say, their assumptions about the world, think that there are some very kind of objective truths that always exist, that people have natural rights and it's always wrong to violate them. Things like, you know, killing people or stealing things from people. In your experience, how does that differ from the socialist view of reality?
Sure. We say that in the capitalist world, Ayn Rand coined the phrase, and that was not from a biblical background, of course, at all. She's very much an atheist, but the idea that we have an objective reality, a concrete reality. And we discover that through logic and data and the scientific method. And that's how we knew that lightning bolts weren't thrown by Jove out of the clouds, right? It was simply done by electrons being stripped off of polar H2O molecules by the friction of the planet Earth. And then we harness that power. So that's capitalism. It's rational thought. It's the mind, the human mind. To the left of the socialist, reality is not that at all. It's what do they feel about something. It's really emotionally based, and data gets in the way, and they discard it, and it makes it very difficult for us to argue objectively with the left, because what about the children? And I can show them all the data in the world that capitalism is better for the children, but they don't seem to care because they're emotionally invested in the idea that their preconceived notion is that socialism is good for the children. So it's just emotion. It's not logic. It's not data. It's not science.
Right. Well, Michael, I think I know you have a nice saying that you have when you're comparing things like laws and kings, and I think that can inform the discussion.
Well, actually, thank you very much, Chris, because I think this is a very important point that we discuss in terms of how reality can be molded by man. If it's left up to us, we can be quite arbitrary, we can be quite inconsistent, and if we're put in a position of authority, we can declare what is true, and that is what I refer to as the king is law versus the law is king. And so when I was homeschooling my daughter on these principles back when she was in the sixth and seventh grades, I recall trying to present this concept of natural law versus political law. And this is when I coined this phrase, king is law or law is king versus king is law, so that people could, that she could understand, and I hope our listeners can better understand that when we're talking about the law is king, we're really talking about natural law. You know, when the king is law, then whatever the king's decisions are arbitrarily, they happen to be the law for that particular moment, for that particular king. And
yeah, that's true. Go ahead.
Yeah, but please, Paul, comment on it if you would.
Well, it's just the idea that the reality is simply declared by the state, if you will, the modern version of the king. They simply say what is real. Hugo Chavez doesn't like the data that shows that their economy is in a mess, and so he says, well, throw out the data. Let's calculate something new. Sarkozy said the same thing in France when it shows his French standard of living 30% below the U.S., he says, well, let's throw out the data and we'll just redo something else that shows what I already know in advance, what I feel, that the French standard of living is superior. So let's invent some numbers that show that the French standard of living is superior. So it's simply what the state says it is, and it's how they feel about things. It's not data-based. It's not scientific. It's not at all reality or what Ayn Rand would say objective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like you, Paul, to address a couple of additional questions and points on this, but we are going to run into the end of this particular segment before we can let you get back with an answer. So we're going to close out this section, and we'll be back in just a minute, folks, with our final segment, talking with Dr. Paul Prentice on the moral basis of capitalism with Mr. Christopher Opperman. And so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. Thank you very much. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Dr. Paul Prentice on the moral basis of capitalism. So, Paul, you know, one of the things that came up earlier in our conversations between the breaks was this conversation of definitions. And I remember hearing you discuss on another show that you were on, the term libertarian. And how do you actually define that particular term?
Well, the libertarian, to me, is simply an adult that takes responsibility for their life, and then understands that they have a moral obligation to treat other people with like respect, and then also a moral obligation to do what they can with how they can do it to help other people in certain situations and circumstances. So voluntary charity is part of being a libertarian. Respecting other people and their rights is part of being a libertarian, and being not independent of other people, but independent of government, independent of coercion. Being a full adult, responsible for your life, your family, and then extending that out as far as you wish to into the collective. But it's really about the fundamental principle that the individual is the sovereign. The individual is the ruler of their life. The individual is the uniquely created person who has then this free will, this Augustinian free will, and then makes moral choices based on that.
Yeah, I'm constantly asked, do I consider myself a libertarian? And I tell people that I don't even like the term libertarian. I much prefer the term adult with good manners. And if I'm going to be known as something, I prefer to be known as that as opposed to anything else. But I would like to go into that because I think that the definition of adult and the definition of good manners is also very important for us to talk about. You know, an adult is someone who is willing to take care of themselves and able to take care of themselves. And as a second stage, maybe they're willing and able to take care of other people as well. But that's a choice that they have. And so that's what an adult is. An adult isn't just somebody who's over the age of 21, but somebody who can actually take care of themselves and chooses to do so. The good manners part is, I think, we take it for granted, but it really has to do with how much regard we're willing to give other people. You know, there was a line, I think, in a movie that, and I can't recall the movie offhand, but it mentions the idea of the best guest is somebody who makes the host feel at home. In other words, there's a regard that we give to other people when we are extending good manners, having to do with observing their property, that they have rights to their body and their property and so on. So, Paul, what is your comment on that?
That's actually a wonderful and perhaps likely a brilliant definition, Michael. It's important that we define terms, and we started the conversation with that idea. And that really does define libertarianism in the way that I understand it. And that's against a lot of the common misunderstandings of libertarianism, where a lot of people think, well, that just means I want to take drugs, or that just means I want to engage in promiscuous sex. Well, I may or may not, but it's my choice, and I don't harm people if I'm not harming people. That's really one of the keys to this. And it really is about a fundamentally moral perspective based on the primacy of the individual, understanding your role in the greater society, in the greater culture, and your responsibilities, your rights and your responsibilities. It's not just about your rights to do things. It's about your responsibilities to your fellow man, your responsibilities to treat them with the equal respect with which you expect them to treat you.
Right. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Paul Prentice, for being with us today. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Michael.
And also, I would like to thank you, Chris. Christopher Opperman, thank you for being with us today.
That was a privilege. Thank you.
Okay. So this is Michael McKay, your Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.